This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Exodus. Today, Pastor Sandy will teach through Exodus, chapters 15 through 18. Let's join him now.
Whale, interestingly, was an Egyptian delicacy. And so it's ironic here, God has the Hebrews eating better out in the desert than most Egyptians would have eaten in their own native land. And in the morning, the dew lay all around the camp. And when the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance, kind of like a wafer, as fine as frost on the ground. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And in the Hebrew, the phrase, "What is it?" gets translated manna. Manna. The Hebrews called it manna, but remember, God always referred to it as bread from heaven. In fact, Psalm 78, verse 25, even refers to the substance as angels' food. I like to think of it as little angel food cake wafers all over the ground, man. How tasty. Whatever it was, I'm sure that if you had run chemical tests on it, you would have found that it contained 100% of the USDA daily nutritional requirements. It was the perfect food for desert life, and God was always on time with it, right on time. He never missed a meal. And Moses said to them, "This is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Let every man gather it according to each one's need. One omer for each person according to the number of persons. Let every man take for those who are in his tent." And so each individual got an omer a day of the manna. An omer was the equivalent of about 7 pints. And the children of Israel did so and gathered some more, some less, depending on the number of mouths to feed in the family. And so when they measured it by omers, he who gathered much had nothing over, and he who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need. Verse 19. And Moses said, "Let no one leave any of it till morning." In other words, take only the amount that you needed for that particular day. Don't try to hoard it just in case. He says, notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses. After they had gathered for one day, there was still food on the ground. Look at that. Why don't we take a little bit just in case God doesn't come through tomorrow? And there were some who tried to take as much as they could. And this was not how God wanted his people to live. He wanted them to trust him day by day, not just on occasion. When somebody comes up to you and says, "How's things going?" You say, "Well, it's day by day." You're right where God wants you to be. That's right where he wanted his people living, day by day, trusting him. If God had allowed the people to hoard the manna, they would have fallen in love with the manna and forgotten about God. You see, it's our human tendency to trust in a surplus rather than in God. And this is why a hefty bank account can oftentimes hinder our faith. This is also why Jesus told us to pray, "Give us this day our daily bread." Give us this day our daily bread, Lord. We're willing to trust you each and every day. Jesus wants us to learn to live our lives with a daily awareness of our need for him. To teach the Hebrews to walk by faith, God spoiled their excess. Verse 20 tells us, "But some of them left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and stank." Stanky manna. It's terrible. And Moses was angry with them. And what do you think they did with this stinky manna? They probably took it outside and just tossed it over the fence, which would make it an over-the-fence omer. Verse 21. "So they gathered it every morning, every man according to his need. And when the sun became hot, it melted. And so it was on the sixth day that they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for each one." And all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses, Then he said to them, this is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today and boil what you will boil and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning. Now they do this Monday through or Sunday through Friday, and if they keep back that second day, it rots. There's worms in it. But they do this on Friday night to prepare for the Sabbath the next day, and it lasts. It lasts for 2 days. God saw to it. So they laid it up till morning as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. Verse 25. Then Moses said, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none. Now it happened that some of the people went out on the Sabbath day to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. And the house of Israel called its name manna. Remember, though, God always called it bread from heaven. And it was like white coriander seed. And the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. The manna had the texture of a seed, but the sweetness of honey. It was literally Hebrew nut and honey. Yeah. Coriander seeds, by the way, are the size of pearls. And they give off a sweet aroma. Today, they are an ingredient in gin and in curry powder and in various sweets. They're also used to flavor bread. This is how they're used in the Middle East today. It's interesting. There is a Jewish legend that describes how manna tasted. Now, I don't know if I really go with this or not. It's just a legend. It's just fun. You want to hear it? Here's the legend of how the manna tasted. One only had to desire a certain dish, and no sooner had he thought of it than manna had the flavor of the dish desired. The same food had a different taste to everyone who partook of it, according to his age. To the children, it tasted like milk. The strong youth, like bread. To the old men, like honey. To the sick, like barley steeped in oil and honey. It's interesting, the Jews even claim that to the Gentiles, it tasted bitter. Verse 32. Then Moses said, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Fill an omer with it to be kept for your generations, that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. They were to keep back a sample of the manna for posterity's sake. And Moses said to Aaron, take a pot and put an omer of manna in it and lay it up before the Lord to be kept for your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron laid it up before the testimony to be kept. Later, Moses will take a jar of this manna and he'll place it in the Ark of the Covenant along with Aaron's rod and with the two tablets of the Ten Commandments. It's a shame that we don't have that jar of manna today, isn't it? It's a shame we don't have the Ark of the Covenant. It's stored some way back in the Smithsonian Institute up in Washington, D.C. That's where Indiana Jones put it. Not really. Verse 35. And the children of Israel ate manna 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. They ate manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. Now an omer is 1/10 of an ephah. Remember, an omer was about 7 pints. So the Hebrews ate a omer of manna every day for 7 years. That's 7 pints a day for 3 million people for 365 days a year for 40 years. That's a total yearly requirement of 2.5 million tons of manna. That's a lot of fast food, let me tell you. Think of it this way. Let's say that we were to take over the food service for just one day, for the children of Israel in the wilderness for just one day. And since we, you know, we're not God, so we can't really rain down bread from heaven. So we decide to feed each Hebrew a cheeseburger, some fries, and a Coke every day for 40 years. All right, now here's what we would need for just one day to feed 3 million Hebrews a cheeseburger, fry, and a Coke just one day. We would need 3 million beef patties, a quarter pound apiece. We want to serve them quarter pounders. That's 750,000 pounds of beef. Now, if we were shipping that by rail, it would take a train of 200 freight cars that would require 10 locomotives to pull it just to get the beef to us. We'd also need another 7 cars to pull the 750,000 pounds of potatoes that we would need for the fries. Then we would need 75 cars to carry the 750,000 gallons of Coca-Cola. Then to ice down the Cokes, we would need 375,000 pounds of ice, which would require another 4 railroad cars. Now here's the rest of the grocery list. Buns, we would need 250,000 dozen. Mustard, 11,000 gallons. Dill pickles, 12,000 gallons. Tomatoes, 50,000 gallons. Cheese, 200,000 pounds. Onions, 175,000 pounds. And lettuce, 150,000 head. Now we're talking about a train over 300 freight cars long. Such a train would extend for 3 miles. And we would need to do that every day, 365 days a year for 40 years. Now imagine cooking that volume of food. If you could cook 1,000 patties per minute, and that's going to take a lot of grills, let me tell you. You would have to work 1,000 patties per minute. That would take 48 hours to cook 3 million burgers. Now, that's not figuring the time it would take to peel and cook the fries, and you could probably really get bogged down peeling the onions and the tomatoes and pouring the Cokes. And yet God provided the children of Israel a meal like that every single day for 40 long years. Not even Lisa Shelton and the Brooks staff could pull that off, let me tell you. Exodus chapter 17 begins. Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin according to the commandment of the Lord and camped in Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. Now notice that phrase. They set out according to the commandment of the Lord and they came to a place where there was no water. Notice, God leads the Hebrews to a place where there is no water. This is not what you would expect from God, is it? I mean, surely God always leads us to bountiful places where there's more than enough of what we need. God would never lead his people to a dry well. And yet that is exactly what God does. Guys, I hope you have advanced beyond a preschool faith. It's a kindergarten faith, is what I like to call it. It's when people believe that bad things happen only to bad people and good things always happen to good people. That's an elementary view of things. That's not how real life really works out. You know, if we just have that kind of faith, then every time we make a decision that produces some kind of uncomfortable consequence for us, we think we've missed God's will. Not necessarily. Here, these people followed God's will to a dry well. Sometimes God leads us to difficult places. He leads us to hard times. He leads us to dry and arid periods of our life to test us and to refine us. A.W. Pink, he writes this, "We need to realize that in every circumstance and situation where faith is tested, the Lord himself brought us there. If this be apprehended, it will not be so difficult for us to trust him to sustain us while we remain there. Verse 2 tells us, therefore the people contended with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, why is it you have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? Unbelievable. These people are griping again. And understand, there's now manna every morning. There's quail every night. And yet just because there's no bottled water, they're ready to revolt. Verse 4. So Moses cried out to the Lord saying, what shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me. A lynching mob had formed. And the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river and go. Remember the river Nile when he turned it to blood. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. Here's another miracle. Moses takes his rod, his shepherd's staff, and he strikes the rock with it, and suddenly the stone turns into a sprinkler. I mean, water begins to gush out. It quenches the people's thirst. It's interesting, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4, gives us a commentary on this particular story. Paul reveals that there's a spiritual application to this passage. He writes of these Hebrews, all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. In other words, when Moses struck the rock, he was not only supplying water to the thirsty people, but he was also painting a picture of how God was going to slake our spiritual thirst. You see, in the Bible, the rock is an idiom for the Messiah. Remember Daniel's vision where he saw the rock cut out without hands, striking the image at the feet. That rock was a picture of Jesus. It's interesting, on the cross, what did God do but strike the rock? God struck Christ on the cross. And 50 days after the crucifixion, the Holy Spirit, the living water, was poured out at Pentecost, bringing spiritual refreshment to thirsty souls. Remember, Jesus cried out in John 7, verse 37, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. In other words, spiritual life gushes out from our rock, Jesus Christ. God struck the rock, Jesus. And from that rock, spiritual water has come out to satisfy our thirst. Verse 7 tells us, so he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, which means tempted and contentious. They had tempted God. They were contentious people. Because of the contention of the children of Israel and because they tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Verse 8. Now Amalek came and fought with Israel and Rephidim. Now notice, a month after Israel is saved from bondage, he is now thrust into war, which also is an interesting lesson for us. Become a friend of God and don't be surprised when you end up a target for Satan. Don't be surprised. There is a spiritual battle raging in this world. Life is not a playground. Life is a battleground. And you become a Christian. When you choose sides and get on God's side, you suddenly realize just how real this battle is. When these nomadic Amalekites heard that a new watering hole had opened up at Rephidim, they came to grab it for themselves. And so Israel fought against the Amalekites. And the manner in which they prevail teaches us how we can be victorious in the spiritual skirmishes that we fight. It's also interesting that the Hebrew historian Josephus, he points out that the Hebrews got the weapons from the Egyptians that had drowned in the Red Sea. Apparently, at the shores of the Red Sea, God had worked another miracle, and he had made all of the metal swords and spears and armor float all the way back to the top of the water, back to the banks, where the Hebrews could pluck the weapons out of the sea and then use them in this battle against the Amalekites. God had foreseen the nation's need for weapons and had provided them in advance. Well, verse 9 tells us how this victory was won. And Moses said to Joshua, "Choose us some men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. It was a seesaw battle. As long as Moses held the rod of God high in the air, the people were encouraged and they prevailed against the enemy. But the moment Moses' arms got tired and he started to let his hand slip and the rod disappeared from view, the Amalekites would get the upper hand. But Moses' hands became heavy, we're told. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur, they kind of swung around on his sides, and they supported his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. And his hands were steady until the going down of the sun, and so Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. The arms of Moses had to be supported for Israel to win the battle. And this is a key for us in the spiritual battles that we face. You see, uplifted hands are a sign of our faith. We're reaching out to heaven for help. We're trusting in God to win the victory. But oftentimes our faith gets tired, doesn't it? Our arms get weary and they begin to droop and our faith begins to drop. And it's at that point that we need the support of our friends. We need Aaron. We need her to come alongside us and help us keep those arms up and keep that faith strong until God wins the victory. Charles Spurgeon once said this, "Friendship is one of the sweetest joys of life. Many might have failed beneath the bitterness of their trial had they not found a friend." It's friends that help keep your arms high until the victory's won. This is why the Lone Ranger for Jesus, and I hope you're not him, but this is why that Lone Ranger for Jesus, that isolated Christian, is destined to fall. For when his faith gets weary and when he gets tired, there's no one in his life to help him keep his arms up. Hey, we all need each other. Sometimes we're Moses in need of a lift. At other times, we're Aaron or Hur. Or you might even be a him. But we're the person who comes alongside and provides that lift. But for you and I to win the victory, we need each other to help hold each other's arms high. Verse 14 tells us, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven.' And Moses built an altar and called its name, 'The Lord is my banner,' or Jehovah Nissi. For he said, 'Because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation.'" The Lord will be the banner of Israel. Every army needs a flag, and the flag that will fly high over the armies of Israel will be the Lord Jehovah. The Lord will fight their battles.
Being on the go is something we're all accustomed to in this culture. The hustle and bustle of life seems to make the days just fly by. For most of us, our smartphones are sort of an extension of our bodies, constantly ringing and dinging, telling us where to be and what the next appointment is. The technology that we enjoy in this day and age is amazing. And while there's certainly no end to the bad things we can find online and through our smartphones, there's also some great kingdom-minded options. We'd like to invite you to download the Sandy Adams mobile app. Our mobile app is available for iPhone, Android, and Windows smartphones. Or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the link from the main menu. When you download the app, you'll be able to listen to the most recent messages taught by Pastor Sandy, browse the series archive, and search the archive alphabetically. Finally, when you download the mobile app, you'll also have the opportunity to join us live for our Sunday morning worship service right from your smartphone. Again, to download the Sandy Adams mobile app, simply enter Sandy Adams in the search options of your smartphone's app store, or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the mobile app option right on the homepage. And please join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the Bible right here on Sandy Adams Radio.